on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
I think I'll say, like, first and foremost, that my approach to psychedelic healing and psychedelic therapy and working with people is to never kind of impose any sort of framework or archetype or agenda, right? I don't want to impose my trip on someone else's trip.
Right.
And so because of that, most of it kind of, I would say, emerges organically through their experience. And then I hear about it after the fact. And I hear something that maybe pairs with like an underworld journey, or I hear something about, let's say, I don't know, it's fascinating the imagery that people, you know, encounter. You know, people, I've heard of people, you know, encountering imagery very, very deeply tied to mythology, and they might not have any idea about it, right? It's the same thing with dreams, right? And this is kind of the Jungian dream work perspective as well. So yeah, I mean, this is just a long way of saying that I don't like to impose any sort of archetypal agenda or trip on anyone. And it's usually what is kind of emerging naturally from the psyche itself. And then I'll do a lot of work on the flip side, right? Helping people integrate and then relate to those images.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author and psychedelic therapist Simon Uggler to discuss his book, Psychedelics and the Soul. Simon explains how he incorporates Jungian psychology and mythology into psychedelic healing. He examines the critical role of guides and integration and the potential of psychedelics for healing on personal, cultural, and environmental levels. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Simon Uggler is an internationally experienced psychedelic therapist, educator, and writer. He has a master's degree in depth counseling psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institute, and he has taught for 5 psychedelic facilitator training programs, including Naropa University and Intertech, a groundbreaking legal psilocybin facilitator training program based in Oregon. Weaving together Jungian psychology, mythology, and internal family systems therapy, Simon maintains a private practice specializing in psychedelic integration, masculinity, and depth psychology. Simon draws on his diverse experience traveling across the world and learning from indigenous cultures, including the Shipibo ayahuasca tradition and the Native American church. For a year and a half, he routinely served as a retreat leader and therapist with Myco Meditations, a leading psilocybin therapy retreat center in Jamaica. Having worked with psychedelic medicines for over half his life, Simon is passionate about helping his clients navigate the liminal wilds of the soul, and I just have to say, I love that. He joins me today to discuss his book, Psychedelics in the Soul, a mythic guide to psychedelic healing, depth psychology, and cultural repair. Simon, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Well, I am very much looking forward to speaking with you. We have a lot of shared interest here. And I thought that before we get into the book, I would ask you, I just read your short bio, but I thought I would ask you to speak a little bit more about your background and what led you to working with psychedelics and psychedelic therapies.
Sure. Yeah, I am blessed to have come to psychology by way of psychedelics rather than the other way around. And, you know, we could go all the way back to sort of perhaps overly confident, if not arrogant, explorations as a teenager, some of which, you know, resulted in epic level thrashings, you know, that really taught me that, you know, there is a perhaps right way to work and take these substances, and there is a wrong way. And having had one or two experiences that I would firmly couch in the realm of the wrong way. You know, I kind of walked out or maybe crawled out of some of those experiences saying, okay, I really want to figure out how to do this and what this realm actually entails and requires. And, you know, that led me to eventually studying anthropology as an undergraduate and spending, I would say, a considerable amount of time in contact with Indigenous peoples and cultures, starting with a visit to Aboriginal Australia back in 2009. And then, yeah, you know, really just many years of travel and study. And eventually that took me to the Peruvian Amazon, where I was fortunate enough to kind of have an immersive experience with a family of Shipibo healers who are known for, you know, their mastery of ayahuasca. And yeah, I would kind of describe that as an ayahuasca boot camp, so to speak. It was like, okay, you gringos want to learn our tradition? Here you go. And they kind of just threw their arsenal of purgatives and nasal medicines and steam baths. You know, ayahuasca became sort of the least frightening thing that we were taking over those 6 weeks. And, you know, it kind of left me in a position of feeling like I didn't really actually feel like I wanted to be the guy passing out cups of ayahuasca to other gringos, you know, sort of secretly, you know, in the United States. It just didn't feel aligned for me, you know. But what did feel aligned, that sort of, I would say, revealed itself, you know, over the course of that experience, was depth psychology and the tradition of Carl Jung as kind of like something that I had learned about and encountered and sort of had a relationship to for many years. But it really, I would say, kind of blossomed into my psyche as a tradition that felt 100% not just appropriate for me to claim, so to speak, but actually extremely resonant and something that kind of always had been. And then that led me to grad school at Pacifica Graduate Institute. And yeah, the rest is history.
Yeah, right on. It's a very interesting journey that you've taken in so many different ways. It's one of the things that you had noted in the book, and I wanted to ask you about this, is that it seems that psychedelics are, we hear about the psychedelic renaissance, and you mentioned that you think that they are returning when they are most needed. And this connects into several other things that I think we'll be exploring. But I was wondering if maybe you could talk about that a little bit, because it almost seems as if saying that psychedelics are returning when they're most needed, it almost seems as if there is a agency involved.
Yes. Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, actually, before I answer, I do kind of use the term psychedelic renaissance, you know, a bit ironically, because I kind of have some issues with that term.
Yeah.
So I'll say that first of all, maybe we can talk about that later. But you know, I remember going to a reading that Dr. James Fadiman did in Portland years ago, maybe, I don't know, 13 years ago, when I think the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide came out, and someone asked the question about plant medicines versus synthetic medicines. Maybe I asked the question. I can't even remember. And we kind of got into this discussion of, do different psychedelic compounds have agency? And Fadiman was talking about how he preferred, I think this was a discussion around microdosing in particular. Again, it was a long time ago. I can't remember. But I recall Fadiman saying that he really preferred LSD because he felt that it did not have so much of an agenda. And that, in his opinion, plant medicines seemed to have a bit more of a kind of agenda. And it's a really interesting philosophical question, just from a sort of foundational worldview standpoint, because it ascribes a level of animacy and intelligence to things that our culture and philosophical traditions would describe as, you know, dead, unthinking objects, right? So just the question, I think, speaks to the profound sort of implications that psychedelics have on a cultural level. But I don't know, I kind of tend towards animacy and an animate perspective myself. So I would say yes, and what doesn't have agency?
Right.
So yeah, I think there is a certain level of agency in these medicines, just like I think there's a certain level of agency, you know, in a cedar tree.
Okay. One of the things that I've thought about, because I've worked with the plant medicines myself, both with ayahuasca and psilocybin, but one of the things that I had thought about was that it seems that depth psychology and the depth psychological approach is the natural partner to working with these medicines. And so I've often been thinking that, and we can talk a little bit later about your issues with the term psychedelic renaissance, but I've been thinking that in conjunction with this, there's going to be a depth psychology renaissance as well.
I hope so. I hope so, man. That would be just lovely. You know, I do think folks are rediscovering Carl Jung. I think maybe 10 years ago or so, there was sort of a resurgence in people getting really excited about Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, which kind of never went away. And I think, at least in some of my circles, you know, myth and story and kind of the intersections of mythology and storytelling and depth psychology is speaking to people on a deep level. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, you know, perhaps it, because it speaks to kind of our own forgotten ancestral traditions, which, you know, many of which had oral cultures and oral storytelling as a center point of the entire culture. You know, perhaps it's because it kind of offers an avenue of meaning making for, especially for psychedelic experiences. And yeah, perhaps, you know, it's because, yeah, I feel as if kind of Jung's discoveries and work was kind of like a digging up of this beautiful fragment from like a terracotta amphora, right, buried in the earth for thousands of years. And he found sort of, you know, one or two beautiful fragments that kind of gestured toward a shape. And we can imagine what that shape is. And I think Jung had a very clear picture of what that shape is. But the original product of that thing was something that we would call a culture. And I think our culture is sort of starving for something that holds water, right? Which I think the tradition of depth psychology and myth wants to help us do.
Yeah. I think that all too often, the way I look at this is that depth psychology takes the idea of soul seriously. And that's something that you noted in examining the etymology of psychedelics, because we often hear that psychedelic literally means like mind manifesting. But I really appreciated where you wrote, well, how about soul revealing?
Yeah, that's much closer to the actual Greek roots of the word, you know, psyche meaning soul, and delos meaning to kind of reveal or make manifest. And to make that shift just in our language kind of requires that we take the soul seriously, as you said, because it these aren't medicines that just sort of remain in our minds. You know, I think anyone who's taken, you know, ayahuasca or something, large dose of psilocybin, can clearly express how, no, these are not just mental experiences. These are embodied experiences. These are soulful experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very different way of thinking about medicine. And at one point in your book, you noted a distinction between medications and medicine. And I always make a distinction between drugs and medicine. You know, and it seems like so many people in our culture are just so used to medication and drug rather than medicine and healing. But let me ask you, just for the audience, how would you make the distinction between medication and medicine?
A great question, Nick. I would say that anything that we kind of take, perhaps from a somewhat reactive or unconscious place that we think is going to fix us without us having to put in any of the work, especially something that we would sort of couch in that unthinking, dead object category of this Cartesian situation that we're in. That's a medication, right? Something we can, a pill we can pop every day that will fix us without us having to sort of look inside and do anything about it. I would couch that firmly in the category of a medication. A medicine, you know, is something that I would, again, ascribe a certain level of animacy or agency to. That also requires us to put in a bit of work, you know, that we have to do our homework with, you know, even if it's herbal medicine, right? That's not going to fix us. It might create the conditions for our bodies or whatever to kind of heal themselves, but we also have to kind of meet the medicines halfway. And I would say maybe the most foundational distinction in this question is that a medicine is something that we can have a relationship with, whereas a medication is something we simply consume.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. That's a lesson I had to learn when I first started working with ayahuasca because, and I think that this idea is out there, but I was thinking of it as something like a sort of a magic bullet that I'm going to drink the tea and it's going to fix me. And I realized, nope, that is not how these work. Like you said, I have to do the work. And so, and I think that's an important point as more and more places begin to decriminalize and even legalize psychedelic medicines. It seems like there's a little bit of free-for-all going around because a lot of people aren't taking these in a therapeutic or a ritual setting. They're just, well, it's legal now, so I'm going to take it.
Yeah, and you know, the microdosing phenomenon is a really interesting one. And I'll say, you know, right off the bat, I'm a huge enthusiast of microdosing. I wrote a lot of this book while microdosing. I wrote my master's thesis while microdosing a lot of the time. You know, I love it for writing. I love it for, let's say, a sort of casual day of light introspection, maybe out walking in the forest, right? But there is a sort of, I would say, like insidiously unavoidable and perhaps dangerous avenue with microdosing currently, which goes back to that idea of a medication versus a medicine, because it's almost like we in modern Western culture kind of can't help but consume rather than relate with. And I see so much of the conversation around microdosing kind of like forgetting the fact that these are, you know, very powerful medicines with a lot of things that a lot of things to say, you know. And yeah, microdosing can really easily veer into this kind of territory of like, oh yeah, just take this pill every other day, or just take this pill for 5 days on and 2 days off, and you'll be better. You don't have to do anything. Just take the pill.
And you know, this may take the conversation in a different place, but we'll circle back around. One of my concerns with it is that I see people who don't have a lot of background or knowledge regarding these medicines being taken advantage of. And I think that there's also taking advantage of the indigenous cultures where some of these medicines are coming from. I have seen a few times on Facebook microdosing ayahuasca, and it's just the vine. And you know, I'm not a chemist. I don't know. I know that the vine itself is not psychoactive. And so I'm always kind of curious about the, does that even work? Because the medicine has to be the two. And I understand that it's thought of that, you know, you've got a teaching spirit and a healing spirit that come together for ayahuasca. But it seems like it's just popularized and, like you said, made to be something that we just consume.
Yeah, well, I mean, in every indigenous creation mythology surrounding ayahuasca that I've ever heard of, there's a level of animacy ascribed to the medicine and to the plants. You know, sometimes it's two people who die and, you know, the plants sprout out of their bodies or something like that. So they're, you know, again, these aren't just dead, unthinking plant material, right? This is a spirit and a being that is being related with. But yeah, I mean, I think what you're speaking to, Nick, in terms of maybe the some of the unexpected or unrealized fallout of the microdosing hype is like, yeah, I might get into trouble for saying this, but there's literally no barriers to entry for anyone, whether you are a microdosing quote facilitator, which I have no idea what that means, or, you know, someone getting into it, right? There's no barriers for entry, whether you're consuming it, don't really need much skin in the game in terms of like preparation or, you know, taking it very seriously because it's quote just a microdose, or as a sort of on the other side as like a microdosing coach or facilitator. You know, earlier we were talking about kind of the barriers to entry of becoming a Jungian analyst, which is like thousands upon thousands of hours of not just personal therapy, but supervised hours and all sorts of things, right? It's like, what are the standards of practice for a microdosing coach or facilitator?
Yeah, it's kind of like the Wild West at the moment in terms of some of these substances. And I guess my concern is I'm always very cautious when venture capitalists enter the game, because I think that that's a misuse of the medicines, you know.
Yeah, potential red flag.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So what I wanted to do, actually, one of the initial questions I had for you, so we're going to kind of jump backwards here for a moment, was something that you wrote at the very beginning of the book. And it's this statement: psychedelics are not about improving mental health. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a hot take in this day and age, but yeah, I stand by it, you know, and I think it applies to everything we've been talking about so far, right? If psychedelics are merely about improving our mental health in our little sort of myopic human world, you know, I think we're missing the larger picture surrounding these medicines. And yeah, I mean, you could kind of take that statement as the sort of, I would say, jumping off point for the entire rest of the book, because I kind of spend the rest of the book answering what I mean by that. But again, I mean, it's the question of the soul, because I would say, and I think, you know, some of my like mentors and elders in the field of depth psychology would also say that the soul kind of transcends this understanding of mental health. The soul asks us to go a bit deeper. The soul asks us to look into the inevitability of death. The soul asks us to become more comfortable with grief. The soul is intimately involved with love and life and death and kind of all the things that make us human. And I think psychedelics kind of gesture our psyches toward those places rather than just simply feeling a bit better.
Right. Yeah, thank you for that. And I think the context, and this is in the subtitle of the book, with cultural repair, but it seems like so much of this is healing the soul. And I think this may be something that you wrote amidst planetary crisis. And I've often looked at what's going on as a reflection of what's happening inside of us. It's that, you know, the hermetic idea, as above, so below, but also as within, so without. And we can't heal this world without healing ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there's a chapter towards the end of the book about psychedelics and climate change. And it seems like a sort of, maybe I'm biting off more than I can chew there in that chapter. And I do feel, you know, after the fact, like it barely sufficed. You know, it might be worthy of an entire book in and of itself, right? Because of this very question or dynamic, you know, you called it sort of that, this hermetic principle that you speak to, you know, because I don't think we have any other options at this point as a species.
Well, you know, so many people think that there's going to be some kind of technological fix. And I don't think that's going to solve the problem. You know, it may, but other problems will arise, you know, until we get right with ourselves and right with the world. And I think that at the heart of this is, and you bring this up quite a bit, is relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I really love the work of this guy, Jaron Lanier, who's kind of like a anti-technologist, you know, the guy coined the term virtual reality, and his whole sort of his book he released like 10 years ago is called You Are Not a Gadget. But kind of, yeah, I think there's a movement, and has been for a while, right, towards kind of like a techno-futurist, almost like messianic belief in technology. And I always like to say, like, we have all of the information we need to solve the most pressing problems on our planet. Like, just think about that for a second. We already have all of the information. So what's the problem? You know, and I would say that problem is us and our kind of, let's call it, existential or religious shortcomings, maybe, as a culture. I don't think as a species, I don't think there's anything wrong with us as a species. I think it's a cultural problem. And perhaps a sort of problem inherent in civilizations when they get to a certain level, when they become this little thing called empires that sort of start to, you know, dismantle the very roots upon which they are based.
Yeah, that's a point that Derek Jensen, the environmental writer, makes a lot, is that we're always trying to preserve culture and civilization. That's what we're trying to save, when we ought to be trying to save the earth itself.
Right. Two different things.
Yeah, for sure. I think that maybe one of the things we can do is, I really appreciated and enjoyed a lot of the myths and the archetypes that you brought in to the work. And I don't want to go through all of them, because we want people to read the book. And I highly recommend the book. And I have actually already recommended the book, just so you know. But I thought that maybe we can talk a little bit. And I'm always conscious of people, you know, I don't assume that everyone has listened to every single episode of my podcast. So maybe we can take a step back and maybe discuss a little bit about the role of myths and archetypes sort of in general in depth psychology, and then how they're being applied to psychedelic therapy.
Sure. Yeah. I'll try my best.
Yeah, it's a big question. So I understand that.
Yeah, the role of myths and archetypes in depth psychology. Let's start there. So just sort of basic understanding of what I would say differentiates Carl Jung and his tradition of depth psychology. By the way, Sigmund Freud also depth psychologist, right? Depth psychology really at heart just means a tradition of psychology or a way of working with the psyche that embraces the unconscious as a fact, right? The distinction, I would say, in sort of what we now consider depth psychology, and which is really Jungian or post-Jungian psychology, is the understanding that there is, yes, a personal unconscious, which is kind of where Freud stopped, but then where Jung took it into this terrain of the collective unconscious, which is the sort of inherited, you know, heritage, right? The collective heritage of humankind, I believe, is something he called the collective unconscious. And in this realm that we kind of inherit, there are energies and forces that I would say humankind has sort of been in relationship to, perhaps unconsciously or consciously, for, you know, thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. And there's a lot of energy kind of crystallized in certain, we could call it areas or nodes or expressions of the collective unconscious. And these energies are called archetypes. And they kind of, I would say, I wouldn't say, Jung would say, I think, flow kind of into our experience through certain motifs and channels. And myths kind of articulate some of these things, because myths are expressions of the unconscious, right? They have no author. They are, as James Hillman called them, said of them, myths never were, but always are, you know? And yeah, from a sort of classical Jungian perspective, there's an archetype which can be understood, I think, most simply as an image met with an emotion or instinct. So an image and an instinct, or a strong feeling, those two things, when they come together, have the sort of archetypal signature. Because if it's just an image, but there's no strong feeling that it elicits in us, it's not hitting on that deep unconscious archetypal level. It has to really evoke something profound in us, like reaching to the magma of our being, you know? And I would say the myths kind of seek to articulate humanity's relationship to that realm through these stories and these profound, elaborate images, you know, that just burst forth in myths from all over the world, you know? So, and again, this is a very Jungian take on this. From an indigenous perspective, I think there'd be a very different way of relating with mythologies and creation stories, right? So I want to like give the caveat that like this is firmly in the tradition of Jungian psychology, talking about myths in this way. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, it did. It was very, very well stated. Thank you for that. Yeah, you know, it's, I think Jung tapped on something. You know, we want to be very careful when looking at the indigenous traditions of not colonizing them, not taking them over and respecting them. And I think that there's something within the indigenous traditions that we're lacking in the modern Western world. And we probably had it at some point before colonization and whatnot. So I think Jung is tapping into something very deep and profound within the Western psyche that has been missing for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that we can't learn from indigenous cultures, because some of the myths that you share in the book come from indigenous cultures. How do the archetypes then fit into psychedelic therapy? Because it seems like there are a couple of ways. It seems like they come in for the therapist, but also the person who is working with the medicine.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I came to a lot of the ideas in this book just through kind of working with and hearing about and helping integrate, you know, at this point, like hundreds and hundreds of experiences And again, it kind of like Jung's, I would say, discovery of the archetypal realm. It's just what he is hearing from his clients again and again, right? And noticing patterns and motifs that happen to coincide with the mythology that he also happened to be immersing himself in. I think I'll say, like, first and foremost, that my approach to psychedelic healing and psychedelic therapy and working with people is to never kind of impose any sort of framework or archetype or agenda, right? I don't want to impose my trip on someone else's trip.
Right.
And so, because of that, most of it kind of, I would say, emerges organically through their experience. And then I hear about it after the fact. And I hear something that maybe pairs with like an underworld journey. Or I hear something about, let's say, I don't know, it's fascinating the imagery that people, encounter. I've heard of people, encountering imagery very, very deeply tied to mythology, and they might not have any idea about it, right? It's the same thing with dreams, right? And this is kind of the Jungian dream work perspective as well. So, yeah, I mean, this is just a long way of saying that I don't like to impose any sort of archetypal agenda or trip on anyone. And it's usually what is kind of emerging naturally from the psyche itself. And then I'll do a lot of work on the flip side, right? Helping people integrate and then relate to those images. But I do think there is a way to kind of bring in some knowledge of the archetypal realm, maybe to help people prepare, right? Like the idea of the underworld, for instance, like this might be hard. This might be really scary and intense, and you might face some things, right? This you might really want this to end, right? That is all sort of like priming someone for the underworld, the archetype of the underworld, right? And the descent. If there's any, I would say, archetypal energy or signature that is sort of most interwoven with the psychedelic experience, it would be that archetype of the underworld descent, which is present in so many mythologies and so important, especially to the roots of Western culture, right? There's underworld descent mythologies in ancient Sumeria and ancient Greece that one could say actually like formed the foundation of Western mystical and philosophical traditions. So just that archetype is like enough, to inject such a deep level of significance into people's experiences.
Yeah, and I think that that's a good place to start for folks, especially the observation that this is going to be a challenge. This is going to be, or it could be a challenge. And I also like, I think connected with this is the idea of you're going to have to give some things up. In the book, when you talk about the underworld, you give the Sumerian myth of Inanna going down into the underworld, and she has to leave pieces of clothing or these items that she's got at each of these doors as she moves through. And I know that in especially with ayahuasca, there's the dieta that beforehand you have to be very strict in terms of what you eat and don't eat. And it seems like that is a preparation for the journey itself. But I know too many people where I've talked about my experience and being on the dieta, they're like, oh, no, I can't do that.
Yeah, there's a an ask, right? There's an ask, and even, sometimes people leave things down there that really need to be left, right? Like I've seen people emerge from psychedelic experiences being like, okay, I need to leave my partner now. Okay, I need to leave this job now. Okay, I need to leave this substance behind, whether if it's whatever cannabis or red meat, whatever it is, people emerge and they're like, I need to let that go. That needs to stay down there. and not from a sort of suppressing it, but truly like leaving it behind in the underworld.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work. And one of the things though is with the folks that I have done my ayahuasca journeys with, they always counsel people. It's like if you get that notion of, hey, I need to leave my partner, or I need to leave my job,
Yeah.
wait a little
Maybe
bit.
give it a minute. Yeah.
Yeah, give it a minute or
Likewise.
two.
Yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes these things come up and it's like, oh no. I wanted to look at a couple of, we talked about the unconscious and the underworld, and I wanted to look at a couple of the other kind of myths and archetypes. Again, we can't hold on to all of them, but one that I think is really interesting in a variety of ways is the idea of the trickster. And you wrote in the book, and this is so true, healing is nonlinear and that it defies logic and it can break all conventions of rationality. And it seems like that's the case of psychedelics. And I think that maybe you were referring just to psychedelic healing. I'm not sure, but there is a trickster element to psychedelics in general.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think I loved writing that chapter.
Yeah.
I wish I could have written, yeah, so much more about the trickster, but also don't want to invoke him too directly. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a story in there about a man I worked with who, synchronistic encounters and moments that I've witnessed with psychedelics, only one of which made it into the book. But, a man that I was working with who had taken his first dose of psilocybin on this retreat and was about to sit down in his sort of, dosing spot, and is literally go lowering his body to the earth. And then he shoots up and he pulls out his phone, which is ringing, and he's white as a sheet. And he's like, "My mother's calling me. I haven't had a relationship with my mother in like 15 years. Like, why? Why is she calling me?" And other synchronistic things I've seen, like people have some big sort of forgiveness, experience in their trip about someone in their life, and then they come out and they have a text message from them, all sorts of things like that. It's like too frequent to ignore, So I mean, that's just sort of one facet, right, of how tricksters show up. With psychedelics, I mean, there's so many other facets. Thinking that the experience is going to go one way and it goes a completely different way. Thinking that a certain dose is going to do something when it does the complete opposite. I've had that experience myself, as I'm sure many people have. Either something you thought would be very minimal and sort of, easy turns into some intense, epic journey, or something that you really thought would be a grueling, powerful, extreme experience turned out to be nothing, which, has happened to me before, which is kind of a strange and confronting experience. So yeah, I think to me, in my sort of perspective with all this, like, that's trickster. Just imbued in these substances. And, there's a section in the book where I talk about kind of even the history of psychedelics in the West, in America in particular, is completely trickster's tracks are all over it. Trickster's a thief, in almost every mythology, trickster steals things, whether if it's fire or light or whatever. And psychedelics, at least in the United States, were kind of initially stolen, by characters like Timothy Leary, who one could say sort of ostensibly stole that fire from the Harvard, research institution, or Ken Kesey, who literally stole it from the hospital that he began working at after his first LSD experience there.
The trickster archetype. I mean, because in the book, what the trickster that you focus on is the Greek god Hermes. And that's so applicable. I mean, Timothy Leary, there always seemed to be something very trickster-like about him.
Deeply hermetic.
Yeah, very hermetic. But also, you mentioned Terence McKenna many times, and one of the other aspects of the god Hermes is communication. And
yes,
McKenna certainly had that ability. And so, but the thing I wanted to comment on, though, or kind of talk about, is you had mentioned that one of the trickster aspects is in the dosage that you can't necessarily be certain. You end the book on your own experience during, I think, a winter solstice, where you were going to take 7 grams. And I'm assuming these are dried.
Dried mushrooms.
Yeah.
Psilocybin. Yes. Very potent. Very potent.
Yeah. Yeah. Train. And nothing happened. And I've had that experience too. And it wasn't until, and so I even stopped working with psilocybin for a long time until suddenly it just kind of hit me. I'm like, I think it's time for me to work with these again. And I just stated out loud, I spoke to the mushroom spirit. And I said, I feel that it's time that we work together again. And if you agree, I would like to develop that relationship. And it was like 2 days later, I got a text message from the last person I would ever imagine saying, hey, a friend of mine has been growing these because they've been working with it for PTSD. Would you like some? It's like message received. You know, there's something very magical about the spirits of these plants.
Right, right. That seems like a pretty clear agenda to me.
Yeah,
That story right there, Nick. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I always say that you have to learn how to work with the plant. You have to learn how to work with the spirit.
You know? Yeah.
And that's so contrary. That goes back to what we were saying about just taking a medication. Mm-hmm. It's something you have to develop that relationship with. Something along these lines as well, I'm going to shift us to a different archetype here, and this is the guide. And I think that this is really important, especially as psychedelics become more readily available and we start seeing people, like I said, you know, selling on Facebook that they're, you know, you can microdose ayahuasca, things like that. And I have witnessed a few people who I would say are taking advantage of people who don't know any better, that they're not familiar with the medicines. So I thought that the guide was an important archetype to look at. And the myth that you gave was one that I think a lot of people are familiar with, and that's the sorcerer's apprentice. And I think there's a very valuable lesson in that, in terms of finding guides. So I was wondering if you could speak to the archetype of the guide and the myth of the sorcerer's apprentice a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It, you know, it is one of those sort of folk tales that has made its way into so many people's awareness. I think probably because of the Fantasia
film. Mickey Mouse. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And yet, you know, it is such a powerful teaching story.
Yeah.
And by the way, it doesn't just come from Disney's Fantasia. It, you know, this right. story has roots potentially all the way back to ancient Egypt, or the ancient Middle East, definitely the ancient world, the ancient Mediterranean world, which is also intimately connected with Greece. And so, I mean, there's just a really old pedigree for that story. But yeah, it's about claiming unearned power, claiming unearned authority. And I think, as you just spoke to, you know, there's a, I would almost say like a crisis in the psychedelic field of unearned power, because we don't have these cultural structures, at least in the field of psychedelics, to really ensure any form of legitimate mentorship, any form of what we in the field of psychotherapy call supervision, you know, basic kind of professional protocols that are inherent, and if not like overemphasized in every other professional field of kind of, you know, apprenticeship, residency, as they call it in the medical world, you know, where you work with more experienced people for like a couple years You have a lot of accountability structures around you. You have a lot of community around you, and you have a lot of kind of oversight to do things that are, like me as a therapist, right? 2.5 years of school, a year-long internship, and then multiple years of supervised clinical hours where I'm meeting with a supervisor multiple times a month to talk about my process, to talk about my client's process, to talk about the work, to literally sit and have a conversation with someone. No psychedelics involved.
Right.
So to think that there's this kind of new burgeoning field and it has this kind of new like layer of legitimacy that's been provided by legality and all sorts of, laws changing without any of those structures is absolutely appalling to me
Yeah.
and shocking. It's like, how, what? Like, how, who's driving this ship? So yeah, I'll leave it there for
I share similar concerns because I've seen people who operate like wellness clinics, and I'm always like, well, I don't even know what that means, who are now like, oh, and now we're offering these, and there's no working, there's no integration, there's no counseling. It's just here, take this if you want it. And it seems to me that maybe that's one of the dangers that we're going to have to face. It looks like, trying to form my statements here, going back with like Timothy Leary and the first sort of burgeoning of psychedelics, I know that Leary had been criticized for making these available to a wider audience, right? To more and more people. And it seems like we are still kind of struggling with that a little bit.
I mean, again, I think to me this also speaks to Trickster,
Yeah.
because if we build a wall, Trickster will find its way around it or through it or over it. And so I say all these things of like, oh yeah, we need clinical, we need supervision and blah blah blah. Yes, I agree. We need mentorship and apprenticeship and accountability in this field, right? In this kind of new frontier of this field. And I think one of the reasons we're kind of seeing all of this charlatanism, if we can call it that, or at least just kind of maybe inauthentic practice, is because there is this kind of undeniable, unconscious trickster archetypal energy imbued in these substances that kind of want to break out of the laboratory box or want to break out of the legal parameters or want to kind of dissolve and melt down structures that will contain them, just like they dissolve and kind of melt down psychic constructs that might contain you, sometimes to a harmful degree. So yeah, we're trying to navigate a realm, an archetypal realm that we have very little experience in, which is why I think it's so proven to be so difficult to kind of contain these substances, right? Like, first they were, well, I shouldn't say first, but the last 50 years, highly illegal, highly controlled, right? And now the door is cracked open and there's kind of, the wellness clinics. It's like, yeah, we used to do facials. Well, now we're doing psilocybin, right? So it's kind of this bizarre pendulum shift. And to me, that's just kind of a, you could chalk it up to kind of human or rather like cultural patterns, right? But I also can't help but see a layer of trickster in all of it.
And it seems to me that as we move forward with this medicine, that, and this maybe goes back to your statement, psychedelics are not about improving mental health. This could be fit into this, because I don't think that psychedelics necessarily need to be just for their, if someone wants to work with them to explore their own consciousness, for example. I think that's completely legitimate. And maybe they don't, you know, I don't know if they would need a therapist. It would be nice if there was someone they could talk to just on those levels, because it seems like there's so many different avenues to explore in all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a dear friend here in Oregon who is, you know, firmly in the tradition of the Merry Pranksters, you know, intimately connected to not just that community and you know, the living people who came out of that community, but the tradition of embracing and using psychedelics for play and celebration in a way that is safe and is healing and is profound, right? But, you know, there is a sort of specific intention to sort of what they call banish the bummer from the group experience, because it's like, yeah, this is not a deep therapeutic experience. This is about play. This is about mirth and laughter and revelry. And like, that's okay too.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. Because I have a niece who, I think she's 18, she'll be 19 soon, who is very interested in experiencing psilocybin in particular. And my thought has always been, you know, yes, I hope you do. But I also thought that the best way for her to do it would be with her own friends, her own peers, because I think it would be more, it would be a better setting for her, but also precisely because there would be that sense of joy. You know, she'd be more likely to experience the cosmic giggle, I think, at that point. Yeah. So I appreciate that.
And there's absolutely, you know, precedent for that. And I think there's also just as much precedent for, you know, an initiatory experience, right? Yeah. Of like, this isn't about you with your friends. This is about you, you know, here by this fire all night.
Right.
And we'll see you in the morning.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Both have value.
Both have value.
Yeah, both have immense value. But that also gets to this whole notion, which is still incredibly important, of set and setting. And I think that at one point in the text, you kind of describe the setting almost as creating a ritual space.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the whole experience is ritualized, even if it is playful, right? Even if it is, let's call it not clinical or not therapeutic, there is a kind of an inherent element of ritual, because precisely because of that kind of archetypal pattern of leaving the known world, separating from a sort of normative or comfortable state of being, and entering into a liminal state, whether if that is going down into the underworld or up into some, you know, ecstatic place, you're still severing your ties temporarily to what you've known before and entering into the unknown, and then returning back to that kind of familiar home ground. That is like, what is not ritualistic about that?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's initiation. Yeah. It's totally initiation. It's interesting though. Do you think that with, and I know that you can't speak to all, but in terms of those who have gone through the training to be therapist in this work, is it where most of them do have a kind of ritualized approach to the medicine? I can't personally imagine taking any of these medicines and being in like a hospital room or a hospital bed. That just does not seem like a good idea to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the circumstances where people are doing that, you know, are research based, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of kind of extreme clinical sterilization in the research realm, just because they're trying to kind of reduce the amount of variables, right? But yeah, I don't know, Nick. I think experience is the best teacher. And, I've been teaching in the world of psychedelic facilitation now for well over 2 years consistently, and kind of here and there before that. But it's a 6 month program does not suffice,
Right.
and there's a lot of kind of certificates out there and a lot of programs from well-regarded, well-meaning institutions that are doing their best. I don't fault them
Right.
or anything, right? But it's like you can read about skydiving all you want, but until you're in that plane, it doesn't mean anything, And I think there's sort of, and it's a fallout of prohibition and access, right? But to me, the best teacher is the medicine itself. And someone might go through an entire year-long training program and take the medicine once. Like, excuse me? I don't, to me, that's bizarre. And I know your question was about something totally different, but that's
No,
just where
that's
my mind
okay.
is going to. Yeah.
No, that's perfectly acceptable because it brings up a question in terms of the training. Because I've seen, I know that my alma mater, the California Institute of Integral Studies, has a certificate program. I'm in Denver now, so Naropa's just a little bit, down the road. And you worked with Naropa, I think. And there are a few others that come to mind. More are being developed. And it seems to me that the application process, this is what I've seen of people who are being accepted into these programs, all already have a background in therapy. Typically, sometimes they will let in people who have a background in like religion that they're, I always forget the term and I don't know why my,
Chaplaincy. Chaplain. Yeah.
I
Yeah.
don't know why I was even trying to come up with a way to remember that, but I always forget the term chaplain. But it doesn't seem like someone who may have had, a lifetime of experience working with the medicines who says, hey, I've got this experience. I would love to be able to do that. It seems like the opportunity is being closed there. And I imagine that we need to have a way of, I don't know, maintaining some kind of rigor. But what you were saying, just that just kind of came to my mind. It's like, how, with the certification to work with these medicines as a guide, what should be the background? What should be the prerequisites?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if I have the answer to
Yeah.
that, but what I can say is I've seen both sides of the equation, in folks who I've been, blessed enough to teach. But some people who have, years of experience as a therapist or whatever, and very little experience in the realm of psychedelics, or on the flip side, people who have years of facilitating either underground work or maybe years and years and years of experience with ayahuasca, maybe they're part of the Santo Daime tradition or whatever, who are kind of coming to a program like that just to get their piece of paper, which I think is also totally legitimate, right? It's like, okay, you've been doing this for 20 years, and now this is what the state has deemed necessary for you to do. This work, Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have an answer to like the proper background, but I think to me the key word is experience. The key word is experience, and one session taking medicine or one session facilitating for someone else is in what world is that enough experience? So that's the one thing I do feel very clear about. Is that programs that offer one or two experiences or none? Like I said, they're doing their best. I don't fault them, but let's just be honest about that.
Yeah, I've actually spoken to him a couple times, Tim Reed, who is setting up a certification program in the UK. And part of their program is that anyone who is training, they do go to a place where it's legal. And the requirement is that everyone experiences the medicine.
Yeah, hopefully more than once.
Yeah, I don't know how many times, but I know that it's there. I know that it's there. I also know that in the group that I've worked with in terms of ayahuasca, the ayahuascaero and all the facilitators during the ceremony, they all drink a little bit of the medicine, not a whole bunch, but like maybe a quarter of a cup or something.
That can be enough.
I've never seen any of the facilitators purge, but it's enough to get them on the same wavelength, it seems.
Yeah. And again, it's like a difference in worldviews or perspectives, right? I think there are a lot of, ayahuasca traditions, also like the Native American church or peyote traditions. It's like, yeah, you are in there with them. You and really you're with the medicine, and that connection to the medicine is what is emanating from you that holds the space. It's kind of like you take the medicine to kind of get out of the way, so to speak.
And one of the things that you also discussed in the book, and we've mentioned this about relationship, but the importance of doing this in a group setting. I have friends who are deeply interested in working with the medicine, but that's actually what scares them is being in a group because they're like, no, I don't want to share with anybody. But I can say just from personal experience that the last retreat I went at, there was this kind of ineffable bonding with the group that was there. And that was actually more potent to me, more potent medicine than the five ayahuasca ceremonies that we went through.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've seen that happen time and time again with retreats I've led or groups I've been a part of, where the group itself becomes kind of a vehicle of healing because you get to witness other people in their process and you get to be witnessed in yours. And I don't think there's a lot of containers like that anymore in our culture. Again, going back to culture, right? That allow that level of vulnerability, depth, really seeing people, and simply just time, just spending time around people without kind of work interference or a bunch of technology sort of getting in the way, or it's a really special experience. And yeah, I think there's definitely precedence for, individual work. There's 100% circumstances that require that, where that is what's needed. Let's say, like deep trauma healing, for instance, 100% individual work. The group, though, can really actually potentiate the experience. Just like meditating with a group of people is a different thing than meditating by yourself. It, to me at least, like, subjectively feels completely different and almost enhances it, I would say.
It's a fascinating experience. And what I normally tell my friends is that I don't think that any therapist would force them to share, like in sharing circles, but that they may be surprised that they may end up feeling like they want to, after hearing the others be so vulnerable. And the sharing circles have been these moments of tears and laughter, and it's just remarkable.
Where else, can we reliably experience such a thing? Like very few places.
Well, it seems that's also part of the issue that we're facing, and part of the healing is to learn how to be members of a group again in a healthy kind of way where we can be vulnerable with each other and share.
Yeah, it's a special thing when people, even especially when there's sort of time put in to those things. It's not just sort of a one-off group, but sustained relationships that are built through those experiences I've seen just be very, very powerful, you
Yeah,
know?
absolutely. I know we're getting towards the end of our time, but I did want to address, and I think this is so important, and we've kind of touched on it a little bit, integration. There's actually two things I want to talk about. One is integration, and then I want to circle back around to psychedelic
Yeah.
renaissance. Yeah. Because integration is something that is so crucial to working with these medicines, I think. And and I like the mythic story that you shared with the integration, but I was curious if you could speak a little bit about I'll just say like an archetypal approach to integration. I think it connects to Jung's idea of individuation, of becoming whole, but I see that as an ongoing process.
Yeah, well, a lot of the ways that I work with people, again, kind of, yeah, the way that I work with people is kind of oriented towards digging out and sort of finding these sort of mythopoetic or archetypal threads woven throughout their experience. You know, it might be a particular vision they've had or some sort of turn in their own inward journey, you know, but I love working with imagery and visions from a mythopoetic standpoint, which I think I talk about in the first chapter. And then, yeah, the last chapter is focused on integration. And I think the myth I tell is called the, I call it the half girl, but it's originally told as the half boy. And I believe Michael Mead was the one who started telling that story, which is a folk tale from Borneo. But yeah, it's essentially about kind of meeting the other half of ourselves that was sort of cast out into the wilderness, you know, so to speak, a long time ago, which we could also call shadow work, you know, and shadow integration. I use that word a lot in a different chapter. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's also kind of paradoxical too. Like you said, like because it is a process of returning to wholeness, and also it is an ongoing kind of spiral of like also letting go of this idea of healing and wholeness and perfection, right? Which I think is very alluring for our kind of puritanical culture that like one day we'll just be perfect and healed. Which I think is also part of the integration process of accepting the wounded parts of ourselves, you know, which is what that story of the half girl I think is really about, is accepting the sort of gnarly, not pretty parts of ourselves and learning to be with it and then re-enter community as that sort of full person.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really important message, which gets back to the healing of our souls amid planetary crisis, is that, you know, the experience is a deeply personal one, but we have to go back into the world. And it's going back into the world after having gone through these experiences. Seems like that's where we can affect the change.
Yeah, there is a need to return to our community or to find our community, you know, and I think I hope, I pray that we are kind of collectively, at least here in the West, kind of collectively slowly unraveling this myth of the kind of individual lone hero that is the one that's going to solve everything. I think I don't really go into the hero's journey and or talk about that, but I do think that, you know, we've had enough heroics, you know, we've had enough of the sort of lone hero out there with his gun, right? Like, quote unquote, fixing things. And I heard Stephen Jenkinson say once that heroes don't make things better, they just accentuate what is already wrong.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's the hero's journey. I mean, no offense to Joseph Campbell, but it seems to be overworked. I think overworked.
Yeah, it's also kind of easy to extract, I would say, like something that actually just sort of bolsters the ego out of it. It can be a very ego-driven trip, so to speak, when we kind of start overlaying the hero's journey on everything. Because who else is in the story? No one. It's just you. It's just about the hero. That's it.
Absolutely. So I did want to kind of circle back just a little bit to your issues with the psychedelic renaissance. And what really prompted that is, as I was looking at my notes, there was this sentence here: "Nothing will change with the advent of the psychedelic renaissance unless an animistic perspective is brought into the center of this work." And we've touched about, the animism here a little bit, and the plants are their own sort of spirit and consciousness. But I would love to know your thoughts about this, because it's interesting. I'm not sure how that will happen.
Me neither. But I have a hunch that taking psychedelics will help. Hence the need for experience, you know. I don't know how it will happen either, but what I've seen is that people tend to naturally gravitate to animistic perspectives by way of taking psychedelics almost as an afterthought. It's not like someone is primed and they've been reading a bunch of anthropology or something like that, and they have a psychedelic experience and it kind of aligns with what they've been priming their consciousness with. It's not like that at all, at least from what I've seen. And in fact, there's a study that I cite in the book that Roland Griffiths chose to highlight at, I would say, his last sort of public speech at the MAPS conference last summer in Denver, which is something about how a single psychedelic or a single psilocybin experience can ascribe consciousness to unconscious entities, so to speak, which is a fancy way of saying psychedelics will make you feel or believe that plants have consciousness, that objects maybe are less about being sort of dead, inanimate, unthinking things, which is what we put plants into, but actually have something to say and some sort of presence or consciousness imbued in them, which I think the implications of that, which Griffiths really underlined in his speech, which is that it gestures towards the potential of waking us up as a species as to the animacy of our planet, you know, which to me speaks loudly to helping solve the climate crisis. And Griffiths, in that speech, called psychedelics an essential tool for the survival of our species, which is not a small thing to say for a man who spent his entire life as a scientist at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, the term that I've heard is ecodelics.
That's a good one. Is that who coined that one?
I'm not entirely sure. I believe the first time I read that term was in association with, I think, Travis Cox at Naropa.
Nice.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. And also David J. Brown, who I recently spoke to, he talks about something very similar, but I don't know that he used the term ecodelic. But it does seem to circle us all the way back to the very beginning, that the medicines are appearing, reappearing at precisely the time that they are most needed.
And I think that that applies equally to people's individual situations, which we could describe as a crisis of mental health, to our collective situation as a culture, which is sort of a crisis of community and belonging and ritual ways of being with those two things, all the way to our planetary situation, which is one of destruction and extraction and, you know, runaway, this runaway train of consumption. you know, and without sounding naive, I do believe that psychedelics have something to say to all three of those levels of crisis that we are all facing.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Good medicine at just the right time.
Yes.
All right. Well, Simon, I know that we are out of time, but let me ask you the final questions, which are always, what do you have coming up next? What are you working on? And where can people go to find out more about you and your work and maybe some of the retreats that you offer?
Sure. Yeah. A good place to stay in touch is Substack, first of all, which is just simoneuclear.substack.com, or you can visit my website, which is just simoneuclear.com. And yeah, I offer retreats every now and then throughout the year. I have one in August, which I think will be a little too soon for this episode, but definitely going to be offering more, you know, retreats in the future. And yeah, I'm hoping to do a little small book tour this fall, you know, in the West Coast and Colorado and maybe New York as well. So
Okay, wonderful. I will keep my eye out for that. And if I see you at Denver's Tattered Cover, perhaps I'll come in and say hello.
please do. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, and I think it's a book that is for not just the guides, but also for the people who are taking the medicine as well. I think there's value for everyone in the book.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for the kind words.
Yeah, of course. Well, Simon, thank you again for your time. I very much enjoyed the conversation and appreciate it so very much.
Likewise, Nick. Yeah, thanks so much.
And that's a wrap on episode 156 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're a part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media too, please, and subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until the next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.